Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dot Foil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. I'd like to welcome Susan Oberlander. She is the New Mexico State Librarian, and Christy Snyder is with the Global Center for Cultural Entrepreneurship, and she is with Fast Forward New Mexico, which is a project of the State Library. She's also a cultural anthropologist. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So the we've never had the State Librarian on before. What is the State Library? What does it do?
The State Library is a state agency as part of the Department of Cultural Affairs, which makes sense to me. It doesn't make sense to all people, but it always has made sense to me because we're all about preservation of culture and history. And other parts of Department of Cultural Affairs, for instance, are all the state museums, like the Art Museum downtown, the History Museum downtown, things like that. So the State Library fits well into that preservation of culture mission, and we preserve a couple of things. We are by statute, we're the state document depository of the state, so all state agency, all state government documents come to us.
So like when a law is signed, the bill ends up in the State Library?
It's there. And documents from state agencies, if you were working at the Public Regulation Commission, for instance, you would send all of the documents with a case before the commission, all the pleadings and the decision and things like that would all go there.
Are those still made of paper or are those digitized now?
Many of them are digitized. Probably the majority of them are, but some of them are still paper. And then we're finding increasingly that even with digital or born digital copies of documents, that there's a lot of uncertainty about how to preserve them, actually. And sometimes paper looks like a better option. Paper lasts for a long time. We know we have paper from, the 12th century that might be a little spotty, and we really don't know. There's no absolute assurance yet about how to preserve digital for the future. So you kind of take your options today and you hope it all rolls every time it rolls.
Right. I was thinking about that when I saw a weathered CD in the street outside of my house with all the material worn off, like run over by car tires. And I thought, is this what anthropologists of the future are going to have to work with?
Yeah, right. I know. It's an interesting problem, but I think it'll be solved as many other problems get solved as they develop. So we are the state document depository, and in that role, we serve all New Mexicans who have need of state government information. And we also especially serve state agencies who need research assistance and can ask us for to help compile information, to compile bibliographies, to find primary source information for them. So that's very helpful to state agencies who usually don't have libraries or librarians. And that's one of the things that we do.
So you employ professional researchers.
Yes. And so the state documents, we provide access to them, not only by making bibliographies, but we also catalog them in a catalog so you can find them online, which is another really important service. The state archives also receive copies. Well, we give them a copy of all state documents. And they also have them, but they have no access points to them. So they reside in the vault. But if you want to find them, they're much harder to find. If you're a historical researcher and you want to read all the documents of a governor, then the archive is the place for you. But you have to read all the documents to find the one you want. Whereas with state documents, you can search by subject matter or agency, or if it's a repeated annual report or something, you can search by that name and find things.
Now, do you have a rare books library?
We do not really have a rare books library. We have a Southwest collection that has many rare books that don't you can't check them out, can't take them out of the building or anything. And a historical newspaper collection and a very nice Southwest collection that's used by many Southwest researchers. Since we're in the same building with archives and records, the state historians love that setup. It's, you know, a one-stop shop for them, whereas you have to go around to, you still have to go to other places. We don't have everything. Downtown at the History Museum, there's a history library that has a special collection that's slightly different from ours. But we do have a lot of historians come to our Southwest collection.
So the State Library, there's a State Library which I must admit I've never been to, and then there are many city libraries, both in Santa Fe and municipal libraries all around the state. How do they interact with each other?
There are 90 different public libraries in the state, and they're all, as you say, individually governed by cities, by counties, by some of them nonprofit. There's some, for instance, in unincorporated areas that are nonprofits who just become a library and raise their own funds. They, in other words, there's no tax base for them. For instance, there's libraries like that in El Rito, in Abiquiú, Dixon. Those are some that are unincorporated. The little towns, villages wished to have a library and they created their own. But probably three quarters of them are incorporated in some governmental entity. So they're all standalone. They're all governed independently. The State Library, one of our other missions, is to provide support and services for public libraries around the state. So we do a lot of training. For instance, we offer trainings in how to manage certain library functions. We do trainings in advocacy, how to make sure your citizen and your governing body knows the value of your library, because that would be the funding source and an important you know, skill to have. And we also do things like right now we've been working for a year to help public libraries pick online catalog systems. They either do not have an online catalog, or there's a vendor who's been servicing a lot of small public libraries that's going out of business. So all those they need to transition. And so we have someone who is a computer and cataloging expert, and she's helping all of them by inviting vendors to come and offer demonstrations with her to kind of help facilitate, ask leading questions that librarians may or may not be able to ask themselves.
It never really occurred to me, but buying the software to put your online catalog on is a huge decision for a library.
It is, and it can be a large expense, a large part of their budget. There's ongoing costs to it as well, because you pay a vendor to maintain it and upgrades and things like that. And, you know, we have very, very large number of small libraries with one person, maybe a librarian by training, maybe not. And those are hard decisions. For me, it's hard to know what's the next computer to buy. So certainly it's hard to make that consumer choice for a library, but they do really well. They're very tough, those librarians in the field, and they're very beloved by their communities because they're there to help them. So,
and all the children know them.
And all the children, especially the children. We also manage a summer reading program for the public libraries. So we develop the materials and the book lists and everything, and do training, how to make all kinds of arts and crafts connected to the topic. This year it's water. Last year it was reptiles or something, I think was the topic last summer.
Nice.
And we do trainings at the public libraries, and then the public libraries all do summer reading programs. I believe all of them. They attract like 65,000 kids every summer, and it's their biggest, sometimes their biggest programming event of the year. It goes on usually in June and July, and it's fun. We also know, of course, that the kind of not so fun, but really worthwhile part is that kids in elementary school who read during the summer maintain their reading levels better than kids who don't read in the summer. So we also know that it's beneficial to the kids in their communities to do these programs.
We're talking to State Librarian Susan Oberlander. So are people still reading books? I mean, that sounds like a silly question, but there's certainly so much more other kind of media in people's lives.
There is, certainly, and we see the use of all kinds of media in libraries now, but we still see the checking out of books increasing every year, you know, going up 5 or 6% every year. People are still going to check out fiction, going to check out books about how to paint furniture or all those kinds of things, how to get a GED, you know, all those kind of traditional public library collection benefits still accrue. And the children's collections are still used very heavily.
Why is it going up? Why do you think the circulation of books is going up?
Well, I think that more people are coming to libraries, population grows, and it's a valuable service that just doesn't really lose its value. We also see a big increase in the use of the free computers in libraries, and sometimes it seems to be almost a mutual benefit. People come for the computer, but then they also go, you know, I really wanted to read this book, like the new Michael McGarrity, you know, book or something. And I could get it here. Or my kid is in the children's reading room, and now they want to check out 5 books. And so librarians consistently tell me that the computers seems to add to the traditional library value. People still need them both.
How do you see the role of electronic books, whether they be Kindle or whatever medium finally ends up being the standard, affecting libraries?
Well, that's a really interesting question. And of course, the verdict is out. We don't know, because not that many people really have Kindles. My guess will be that Kindles will come into public libraries just as audiobooks, books on tape, whatever you know them as, just as things like that are now a part of library collections. It's not that getting books on tape to listen into in your car from one of those companies that offers them really put libraries out of business, because sometimes people wanted to read the book after they heard it. And libraries also have audio books, so you can get books from libraries. So I'm assuming that the next thing will happen will be that there'll be licensing arrangements with libraries and electronic book publishers. And you can download things from your library. There may be equipment also available at libraries to read books. I mean, just if you look at the path of technology connected to what we think of as reading, it's libraries technically are not necessarily at the cutting edge of a new technology. I think it's too uncertain at the cutting edge, even for some consumers like me. You know, I'm not an early adopter either.
Right.
But eventually, libraries have a part in everything that has to do with reading. I don't even worry about Kindles, because we've already seen 2 or 3 iterations of things, of technological changes, that have really only made libraries more valuable in their communities, like the internet, which has made libraries very valuable to their community.
Well, I certainly check the Santa Fe Public Library card catalog on the internet all the time.
Yes, exactly.
For example.
Right, and find things and probably use databases there. You know, like magazines online, if you're looking for an article on a certain topic, you can do that remotely as a customer of the Santa Fe Public Library, which is actually one of the other things that we do at the State Library. We pay for state subscriptions to databases like Magazines Online and Newsbank for all the libraries in the state. And that's another technological thing that is really valuable, still connected to libraries, that libraries facilitate the interaction or provide the entry point into the database. So,
now, when I was in high school, and none of this existed yet,
We learn to use, for example, the Reader's Guide to Periodic Literature and all that kind of stuff. Are high school students learning the online and technological versions of all those things? Do high school classes come into the libraries and learn this stuff?
I think so. We buy magazines online, as I said, a statewide license. So it's also available in all school libraries. And I believe that generally those school librarians or teachers are helping, well, or being helped by their students to use those right. online resources.
Yeah, before we went on the air, I was telling Susan and Christy that my stepmother's son taught her to use her computer when he was 4.
Exactly. Right. Going on. So one way or the other, I mean, I think that the magazines online and databases like that, that's a vendor name for a certain database, but there's several kinds of databases that reproduce the Reader's Guide, but they have full-text version articles. So you not only use them as an index, as you did Reader's Guide, but then you don't have to walk to the shelf and find the book and read it there or copy it, or you just click on the title and read the full text and print it if you want it. So it's certainly, as those of us who have recently or have in the last 20 years been in college and graduate school also, we all know that we don't really go to the shelves very often.
Yeah, exactly. Now, you are doing a project called Fast Forward New Mexico.
Yes, we are.
Tell us about that.
The State Library is partnering with University of New Mexico Los Alamos, University of New Mexico Continuing Education, the Global Center for Cultural Entrepreneurship, and the First Mile Institute to bring a program, as you say, called Fast Forward New Mexico, that's about the internet, broadband, internet training, and the value of all those things to citizens. The grant comes from the Department of Commerce and is technically called a Sustainable Broadband Adoption Grant, which is the government's, under the federal stimulus funding endeavors, it's the government's attempt to help people learn how to use the internet and discover the value of broadband, which is nothing but the vehicle for all the content that people need and want over the internet. And I think it also highlights, these grants also highlight the government and I think all of our understanding that the internet's an invaluable resource for all of us. And I mean, it's great if you're looking for a glass top coffee table, certainly, but it's certainly more than that, as we all know. And that many employers now require job applications to be filled out only online. A lot of government resources are available only online. Immigration sites, workforce solutions sites for unemployment and things like that. And there are, as we alluded to, the research needs of all of us in different reasons and ways in our life. So the internet is seen as an economic driver, really, of a lot of aspects of life and business and personal development. So I think it's in that sense that the federal government is looking to help promote the internet. Then the interesting thing is the focus in these grants on public libraries, because public libraries have traditionally been the site where people learn how to use the internet, find supportive staff to help them learn and find things, and it's free. And it's generally the only free place in most towns where you do have support and access to free computers. So I think that ultimately more and more people will have broadband and computers in their home. I mean, we have pretty high adoption rates already, but especially among certain categories of population. But there are a lot of vulnerable populations still that don't have computers and don't pay for some kind of broadband at home. because of cost, because of just don't know how. And libraries serve them. They're the only place that they can be served.
It's an interesting moment because while there was a moment where nobody had a telephone because it hadn't been invented yet, then a few people had them, and then at a certain point it became a necessity of life without which you could not participate in the society, and now we're at a kind of turning point moment where computers are the same thing. I mean, having job applications that can only be filled out online, that's a pretty new development, and it's also one that if you've got the poorest and most vulnerable people in your city or town or village trying to fill out these job applications at the library, then library staff probably is becoming job counselors and fillers out of forms along with the people who are trying to do it.
That's absolutely true. And as the state library, someone who provides support for public libraries, that's a really important change for us, and one that has made Fast Forward New Mexico a really essential grant. And we were very elated when we received it in December, I believe. We were one of the first 18 applicants in the nation to receive one of these grants. We got $1.4 million. And with our partners that I've mentioned before, we're going to design and provide in public libraries in 16 public libraries around the state. We're going to provide internet training in various areas, some basic internet literacy courses and some courses about electronic e-commerce things, how to do e-commerce online.
Meaning how to sell your stuff?
Marketing, things like that, yeah. And business resources online.
Basically, and how to use internet tools to support small business.
And that's what part of Christy's expertise is with the Global Center for Cultural Entrepreneurship, which has that as their focus, to help people in all areas of the state, not just in large cities. If they have an idea for business in their town that requires some outreach, this is an organization that helps them learn how to do that. Christy probably has other examples. I usually think of Tierra Wolves up by Tierra Amarilla in the north, which traditionally was an area of sheep herders and wool makers, however, you know, whatever that terminology is, but you shear and card and dye and get the wool ready. And Tierra Wolves is exactly that kind of cultural entrepreneurial activity that was able to, in the place where they've always done it, still has sheep, sells wool, and a lot of it's over the internet. And I think there's other examples around the state, but since I'm from Rio Arriba County, that's the one I know about the best.
What are some other examples?
Well, last year we did the Global Center for Cultural Entrepreneurship, I'll just say, is an endeavor of Tom Augustin and Alice Lloyd. Tom Augustin runs the Museum of New Mexico Foundation, and they both had a strong interest in helping people whose business endeavors had something to do with expressing or maintaining cultural practice in some way, helping them with business development at all stages. And so last year, we did a kind of a research project in the three northwestern counties of New Mexico, San Juan, Cibolo, and McKinley counties. And we work with individual cultural entrepreneurs that would be artists, craftspeople, people who do local food systems production, some cultural tourism if the effort is really truly coming out of the community, and then also a few manufacturing operations that help to support cultural practice. We do a lot of facilitating of communication between community members and also between entrepreneurs and policymakers. And we try to find people with certain kinds of expertise who we can then connect to these entrepreneurs. Entrepreneurs are people who have ideas, cultural entrepreneurs are people who have ideas about bringing together that sort of urban bureaucratic management kind of system with their own community systems, with their own cultural practices, and somehow making the combination of those things bring in a livelihood and help to maintain those cultural practices at the same time.
What does that look like here in New Mexico?
That looks like anything from grants New Mexico a small post or in-between industrial community trying to reshape its conception of itself, and the Double Six Gallery in Grants, New Mexico is a really interesting art gallery that is a cooperative gallery, has members from all of the different kinds of groups of people that are represented in that community. So it has landscape, New Mexico landscape painters, it has Acoma potters, very contemporary artists, and it's one of the few places where you can really find all of those things brought together in one place. So they had a website that was half built, and in some of these areas, the internet is something that people want to use for marketing. They want to use it to communicate with customers who might be in Japan or Germany or something like that. But there are these stumbling blocks, not knowing how necessarily, or having this idea that you have to have much more of a skill base to be able to use the internet than you actually do. So they had trouble with their website, and so we were able to connect them to a local person who could help them with that. It looks like a group along Route 53 in the El Moro area who are a community group that has come together to buy the Lewis Trading Post because they want to be able to sell some of the local products that are being grown in the area and some of the value-added products that are being grown and processed in the area. They want to be able to sell them to the community, and there's no place to do that.
Right.
So there's a community effort to buy that trading post to make it a place where people can sell, local people can sell to local people, and they need help with various kinds of business development and bylaws and articles and just figuring out how to generate those ideas into a functional business system.
The thing that I think is really interesting about what you're saying is that you have a very high-tech tool which in some way is allowing people to maintain their ways of life which are way pre-high-tech.
Right. Yes, and that's that connection between some of the innovations that have happened in business and management practices to also help people pick and choose from that system, as well as to help people pick and choose from the internet systems that are developing, to pick and choose things that will actually support what they're already trying to do, as opposed to sort of distract from that. And that's where my engagement with this project sort of lies, is the work that I've already done in these communities, and then
as an anthropologist, and seeing
this as an opportunity to help people bring internet tools and engagement with the whole system of the internet into their lives in a way that supports these practices and what they're trying to do already.
Christy Snyder is a cultural anthropologist. She's part of Fast Forward New Mexico, and Susan Oberlander is the state librarian of New Mexico. So when you're going to different places to train people in using the internet in these ways, both in cities and in outlying areas of New Mexico, whom do you train? You're going to have to train people who in turn train other people.
That's right. We're working with, as I said, a couple of partners like Christie's organization, and those organizations are going to develop curriculum in different areas, the basic internet literacy areas and the cultural entrepreneurship areas. And then we're going to hire trainers to go to the libraries. In some cases, we're hiring regional trainers to go to the different libraries. We have an organization in Albuquerque that's helping do Spanish translation of some of the materials and some of the things on the website that will be developed, and offer some of the classes in Spanish if that's appropriate. And so the trainers will go to the libraries. Classes will be held for the public. the second part of it is the train the librarian, train the trainer part of this, which in this case the second level trainer is going to be the librarians, because as we discussed earlier, the internet usage is going up, up, and up. 65% in the last 5 years, it's increased. And librarians are struggling, as you said, to be all kinds of advisors. It's not just...
Yeah, they weren't trained for that in school.
Exactly. Not just how to use a mouse or how to do my internet or my email. It's also, well, can you tell me what this immigration form says? Or could you help me write a resume? And a lot of the libraries are doing one-on-one support right now. And we hope that these classes and these training modules that we'll develop, which will be available on the website, the materials will be created, and the librarians will learn how to teach these classes. We're going to, as I said, have classes in 16 locations, but we're going to bring librarians from those surrounding areas in each of the 16 locations to the classes as well, so we expand the scope of the learning that takes place among librarians. And we hope that, as part of our support for public libraries, that we actually are able to change the way, create a management train, a strategic management change in these libraries, so that the default of doing one-to-one training may change to, well, I'd be glad to help you, but you need to take this class that we offer every Saturday morning on government websites, and then see what you can do. Because, as we know, in this economic downturn, funds are being lost by public libraries. They're not getting more staff. In most cases, they're losing staff. Their usage, however, is going up.
Right.
So they need more efficient ways. They still want to help everybody through the door, but I'm hoping we can help them find more efficient ways to meet the needs of their customers for internet training and use, and we hope.
One of the things that I find fascinating is when you have state-level or national-level bureaucracies that nobody really sees or thinks about or knows, but that are working, that are functional, that are connecting people, that are doing what their tax dollars that they spend are designated for. This seems to be an example of that.
Yeah.
This whole project for me has been a process of learning in Santa Fe, Albuquerque area. When we decide we want to change our internet service, we call Quest, Comcast, we call these very large companies, and that is the obvious option. But from this project, I've been learning that there are these little community broadband providers all over the state, and some of them are very community oriented, and it's a whole entire system, like a web, that I didn't know existed. This whole broadband effort, broadband expansion, figuring out do you want to lay fiber, do you want to do wireless, do you want to do satellite, like all the different ways, all the different options, and all the different providers, and the way that that all comes together in a kind of statewide community effort to get this service out into the public, you know, for me it's, and yes, and I didn't understand how the libraries worked really either before I had this job.
Well, and that's, Christy's sort of led into the second part of the grant, and actually the ostensive reason for the grant, the sustainable broadband adoption. The idea being that if more people know why they need the internet and why it's valuable, more people may wish to have some kind of broadband connection at home. What we know in New Mexico, and it's probably similar to other states, is that there's actually more facilities built out for broadband than people are using right now. So, for instance, I know the telephone company's statistic better than the cable, but in the last year or so, I believe that about 75 to 80% of customers of telephone companies had access to facilities like DSL. And of those 75 to 80%, 45 or 50 were actually subscribing to those services. So the companies had built at some cost or re-engineered existing facilities to make broadband in the form of DSL more available to more of their customers. But yet, there's still a lot of their customers that weren't taking advantage of those facilities. So they'd invested and they weren't getting a return. It's hard to incent a company to invest more when they're not getting a full return on what they already have invested. So part of the thinking at the federal level, and especially at the Federal Communications Commission, in this kind of strategy was to incent people to, well, first to help people use the internet proficient at using the internet, and then maybe thinking about upgrading or taking for the first time some kind of a cable modem, a DSL, or something more, a higher speed service, because they knew why they really needed it at home. And I think that we all believe that the more people who use the service, we think the price will go down too, because that's also one of the reasons why people sometimes say they don't have broadband, the cost. I think that the average U.S. cost last year was like $39 a month for sort of basic home internet, which is getting pretty affordable.
It's funny, last week we talked about the potential hazards of cell phone use, cell phone towers, high-powered electric lines, even radio, all sorts of radio frequency radiation, wireless, and all of those things. Are the and the science on it, especially on things like a low-power wireless network in your house, is really inconclusive. But are health considerations of that kind being discussed?
Do you mean in libraries?
Yeah.
I know that some libraries have had concerns expressed when they put Wi-Fi points, I guess they're called, in their library. I know Santa Fe Public Library had a lot of conversations with citizens about that when they got their Wi-Fi point. I know my background in telecommunications and also working in Washington and at the Federal Communications Commission, I know that the Federal Communications Commission has been charged with evaluation of radio frequency in connection to communications devices for, I think, since 1969, when they created the Environmental Protection Agency. The FCC was charged with radio frequency connected to satellite. At that time, I guess there were probably satellite and black handsets, I guess, in 1969. It's hard to remember. So the FCC has been charged for a really long time. They have a lot of engineers that work at the FCC. They also, I believe the process that they use to evaluate radio frequency effects is through a professional engineering society and then developing standards that are accepted by the ANSI people, the American National Standard Institute. So the FCC evaluates with engineers, and then this national standards organization reviews and takes a position. This is okay or this is not. And
this will be a conversation that goes on for a long time. Because it was interesting. The guy who was on the other day said, yeah, these things are all evaluated by engineers who know nothing about the human body.
Yeah, right. And you see, I'm not an engineer either, so I don't know exactly how they test. But I'm pretty sure they also do test on human bodies, and because that's the danger, right? The danger isn't to your wall; it's to your arm or your brain
or your organs.
Right.
But meanwhile, this something that you were both talking about is intriguing and I think interesting for our listeners, which is that you can get your broadband from Quest or Comcast, but there are also these more localized providers. Who are they? How do you find out about them? How do you get involved with that?
Well, I think Christie's met some around the state. I think a lot of them fall in the category of internet service providers, ISPs. In Santa Fe, Cyber Mesa is
that's
a
who
company.
I have.
Yeah, exactly, is a company like that, and they offer, in some cases, however, unlike Cyber Mesa, who leases facilities from Quest or Windstream, there are wireless, fixed wireless internet service providers in some parts of the state too. So it's a different kind of technology, but again, it's creating kind of the first mile piece of the customer, and then that traffic goes into the big network. And in New Mexico, the big network is, most of the big network is controlled by Qwest. So the middle mile piece goes into kind of big trunk lines throughout the state, and then go to Albuquerque, where they are connected to trunks going out of the state. So that's where how internet traffic generally, and very simplistically as a non-engineer, how I understand how it works in New Mexico. So these local internet service providers are great. And in some cases where there is no other service, the Navajo Reservation, for instance, there are companies like Sacred Wind Communications, who is building a fixed wireless network in lieu of putting cable in the ground.
Christy, what are some interesting examples that you've seen around the state of this kind of work?
In Aztec, New Mexico, which is right by Farmington, sort of an interesting web of community resources coming together around this technology is the library there in Aztec has a very active digital arts program. And it has grown, and it continues to grow, so that through the library, people are learning how to do things like Final Cut Pro, and they're learning how to build their own websites and things like that. And it's a very, very, very successful program in the community through the library. So, for instance, they have a UFO, I'm sorry, Aztec, I don't remember the name, exact name of their festival, but they have sort of a UFO alien festival once a year. And the community came together through the library digital arts program to make a YouTube video for that. And so they're kind of doing their own, advertising their own community events through this digital arts program in the library. And Aztec also has, there's a company called Brainstorm Internet, and they're sort of a medium-sized internet provider that works in southern Colorado as well as northwestern New Mexico. And they're very community-oriented, very community-minded, and they are there to sell internet service, but they're also there to sort of pull the community together around this technology. And so they're willing to work with the community in whatever way that community needs. So if people can only come together sort of as an aggregate and get internet service cooperatively, then they'll work with that. They'll figure that out. If people are way out in the middle of nowhere and there's no fiber out to that area, how do we get it out there? So they have flexibility, and they can kind of serve the community. And that's one of the things that I've learned about these community providers, is that they're willing, they know where they are, they know the communities that they act within, and so they're willing and able to find solutions for those individual communities. So Aztec is one place where you can kind of see the library, these community providers, and the community itself sort of all coming together around this technology to make it a part of the community's functioning.
It's so interesting because the things that you're talking about have, until this point, really been more associated with cities. These are the kind of things that you can learn when you're in some kind of urban center, and now that's no longer true. And that has implications which we can't even begin to imagine.
Yes, and you know, if you're thinking about like an individual artist who lives, you know, who wants to live outside of the city, who wants to live in a rural setting, and traditionally or in the past, the avenues through which this artist could sell his or her work would be relatively limited. They could go into the city to find a gallery that would represent them. Now, not that a website is going to make you a millionaire overnight, that's another thing that people have in their minds, but that you can connect to your customers and you can develop communication and relationship to customers who are, as I said, in Japan or Germany, you know, somewhere far away. That's just a new...
Or Albuquerque or Houston.
Yeah, exactly.
Plus, the other thing that you've really highlighted is the effect on the community itself, to make it stronger, to have more points of contact with all the members. That is really helpful because we see some communities dwindling or not thriving. And if this is a way to create a strong sense of who we are in Aztec and why it's great to be an Aztec, that's a good deal too.
Well, and you have communities that have knowledge because they live on the land that urban dwellers don't have. And if those communities remain robust, that knowledge continues, and maybe other people even get to know them, and there's a kind of equalization that is new.
And I think
if this all works out.
Yeah, if it all works out. And I mean, I think there's, you know, there are a lot of people who think that technology, these kinds of technologies actually work to disintegrate communities because people become, you know, sort of self, like the relationship becomes between the self and the computer as opposed to, you know, but
right. So I'm an artist interacting with my customers in another state as opposed to with my neighbor.
With my neighbors. And I'm not saying that isn't true, but I think that this technology has become a real part of a lot of people's daily functioning. And so if that is to be the case, how can we use it to support community cohesiveness instead of just detract from that? So, and I think I'm not like a cheerleader. We're developing these systems right now. You know, we're figuring this out right now. So it's just interesting to see how these communities are learning to pull this technology into service of community cohesion. And the libraries are part of that.
I think that there's a couple of things here. The community building, to come together to see something produced by the community is one thing. But the other thing that we see in libraries is the request for information, the quest, not the request, the quest for information. And I think sometimes that creates a little community that I would like to share with you. My daughter in college with four of her friends sitting in the living room of their four-person house after dinner. They go in, they sit down, they each pick up their laptop, they put it on their lap, and then they begin to talk. They say, "What if we went to Mount Hood this weekend?" And they all start going like that. And somebody goes, "It's supposed to snow. We could snowboard." And then somebody goes, "Oh, the lift tickets cost this much, and the rental is this much." And the conversation continues in that way, facilitated by instant information that
Very
is part of the online thing. So I think community and the internet can be defined in a lot of very positive ways that are not really disintermediation ways. You know, we're talking like bring together, not isolate, fragment, splinter.
Susan Oberlander is the New Mexico State Librarian. Christy Snyder is with the Global Center for Cultural Entrepreneurship, and she's part of the Fast Forward New Mexico project, which is part of the State Library. Thank you both so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you,
Mary Charlotte.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. And my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, jazz.